things that we always took for granted, though we wonder, can we still do them? Which is putting a big stress on a lot of people.
I'm Tim Gordon. I'm a marine biologist. I'm part of a research group that studies the impact of climate change on the sea and on marine ecosystems. You look around you and you just think, wow, it's all dying. There's been times you cry into your mask and you're just unable to do anything because you look around you and you just realise how tragic it is.
Australia is burning, the Arctic is melting, weather is more extreme globally, and wildlife everywhere is dying, from corals to insects to tropical forests, as we humans pollute the air and water and soils. I'm Gaia Vince, and as a science journalist, I've been reporting on this growing crisis across our planet's ecosystems. It's hard not to be shocked and saddened by the enormity of the environmental changes taking place around us. As we see people and wildlife battling to survive dangerous conditions and mourn the loss of familiar landscapes. But it's particularly hard for scientists and medics who are working at the front line of our environmental changes. In this edition of Discovery from the BBC, I'm talking to some of them about what's being termed ecological anxiety or grief. Ashley Consolo works at Memorial University on the Canadian island of Labrador, and she's been documenting the impact of warming on Indigenous peoples for more than a decade.
We've been working in partnership with Inuit on the north coast of Labrador, talking about this very thing. So the ways in which a changing climate and declining sea ice and rising temperatures and changing weather is impacting all aspects of life, but particularly mental and emotional health. And so we interviewed hundreds of people on the coast over 5 years. And, you know, no matter what age, what gender, how much time people spent on the land, people discuss a whole wide-ranging pathways and ways in which these changing climate and environmental conditions were impacting them mentally, emotionally. And one of them certainly was grief, or as we talk about it here, ecological grief, or the grief that you feel when the places that you care about or the environments around you are changing in ways that cause emotional reactions.
And how did they describe this feeling? How did it manifest?
Well, there's a whole variety of ways. So a lot of people talked about how for their overall health and well-being, and particularly their mental and emotional health, the land was everything. Being able to be out on the land, on the sea ice, being safe, being able to travel, being able to hunt was a freedom. And it was a way of connecting to your ancestors, of connecting to your culture, but also just feeling, you know, well and whole and thriving and flourishing. And so with the climate shifting and the ways in which that's happening in Labrador, people are able to spend less time on the land. So they talked about feeling, you know, sad and angry and lonely and frustrated. A lot of people talked about feeling helpless, that there were these changes that were happening to them and their communities and their lands, but they were helpless to do anything about. And then a lot of people talked about that grief and sadness that comes when you think about not only what's happening to you and how it affects your own life, but what it might mean for your children or your grandchildren or future generations to come. And we worked on a documentary film with all five communities a number of years ago to show how people were experiencing the mental and emotional impacts of climate change. And a lot of people in the film talked about how it's hurting them and hurting them deeply. But near the end, one of the Inuit elders and leaders, Tony Anderson, he says, you know, Inuit are people of the sea ice. And if there's no more sea ice, how do we be people of the sea ice? And that sort of profound existential question is so deep and it's so complex and it's so full of our identity, of who people are when they're connected to environment. And then the grief that comes when that identity starts to shift or seems to be disrupted or degraded based on how the environment is changing.
3,000 kilometers west in Yellowknife, also in the Canadian Arctic, Courtney Howard works as an emergency doctor. She has seen the physical and psychological toll of climate change on her community.
We'd essentially ended up over the course of the summer having about 250 fires ringing the town. It was sort of a drought type of situation. And what it meant was that almost any way the wind was blowing, it was blowing the smoke towards the town. And so it ended up being what Environment Canada has told us was the worst urban smoke exposure in Canadian history. And it
sounds horrific.
It was horrible. It lasted forever. It lasted for 2.5 months. And so every once in a while, there was a day where, you know, the wind kind of came in just the right window in between the fires, and you had a good day and the sky was clear and you could go outside. But the public health advice for these types of events is to stay inside when the windows are and close your windows so that you don't get exposed to the smoke. But that's public health advice that we came up with when these exposures only lasted a couple of days. And this just went on and on and on.
So people were virtually imprisoned inside their home. I mean, unable to see the clear sky. That must have been quite a big change to accommodate mentally, to try and get used to something like that. How did people feel about it?
Not so good. So we saw really increased asthma rates. We did a quantitative analysis that's submitted for publication now. So increased asthma rates for sure. But then we partnered with the local Yellowknives Dene community, Indigenous community, as well as the Kagatu First Nation, and had community coordinators who went and interviewed their community members. And also we interviewed some people in Yellowknife, the city as well. There were five really important themes. So themes of isolation, loneliness, disconnection from the land. And I think that the way Indigenous people speak about their connection to the land so explicitly helped me, as somebody who hadn't ever sort of spoken about it that way, understand feelings I had that I had never really been able to put words to. And so I think about it a little bit as not being that dissimilar from the connection we have to other people that we know really well.
Scientists too are experiencing ecological grief, and because their training emphasises treating the subjects of their research objectively and dispassionately, they risk struggling alone with strongly felt emotions. In an unusual move, three British scientists wrote a letter to the journal Science in late 2019, headlined, "Grieving Environmental Scientists Need Support." Andy Radford of Bristol University was one of the authors. He says the letter touched a nerve with other researchers.
I think it would be pretty unusual for there to be someone working in the environmental sciences who, by definition, probably has a love of the natural world, a love of wildlife, to be able to experience this destruction, this heartbreak, and not feel some sort of grief. So I think it's incredibly widespread. And one piece of sort of evidence, small evidence for that in our own work, is that having written this letter that was published in Science, saying that it's important that environmental scientists are given this opportunity to grieve, given this opportunity to cry, to move beyond that and start seeking solutions, is we received lots of messages, you know, through Twitter, through Facebook, on the ends of media articles from environmental scientists, some of whom we knew, some who we'd never met before, from all around the world, thanking us for expressing these ideas and feelings that they are having, but, you know, no one had necessarily thought they could put it out there.
One of the other authors of the letter is Steve Simpson of Exeter University, who has spent the last two decades studying coral reefs, and in particular the community around Lizard Island on Australia's Great Barrier Reef. Healthy reefs are brightly coloured, but in the last decade, many have died through increased cyclones, warming temperatures and increasing acidification.
Corals live in a very close symbiotic relationship with algal cells that they host inside the tissue. And these algae photosynthesize. When it gets too warm, this interaction breaks down. Corals get rid of their algae, which turns them ghostly white. And if they can't then re-establish their algal symbionts within about 3 weeks, then they start to die. They start to starve to death, effectively. So when we went back to the Great Barrier Reef after this major bleaching event in 2006, it really had turned into a graveyard. It was a kind of sepia, dark yellow, slightly green, fuzzy-looking reef. You could see the corals, you could see the shape of the corals, but they were all dead. And what looked really weird was that the fish, obviously, were still brightly coloured. It looked like someone had gone in with false colour and painted all the fish because they were so bright on an otherwise black and white photograph. So it was completely devastating to see areas, individual corals, individual reefs that we knew and loved and had spent so long studying, now lying there dead.
I mean, this is the subject of your research, but beyond that, there's an emotional reaction, isn't there?
That's right. I mean, you know, it was just a tragedy. One of my PhD students I've been working with on this, Tim Gordon, between the time of recruiting him for a PhD, which was going to be studying all sorts of exciting things about fish behaviour, and as getting out for the first field season, the Great Barrier Reef died. You know, 80% of the corals where we work were gone. Most of the fish that lived there had also then moved on. And so I took him to what I told him in the interview was going to be this most wonderful experience. I took him to somewhere that was nothing like that. It really was just this this tragic graveyard of historic coral reef life.
How heartbreaking. And what do you do? What does a researcher do when the subject of their research has disappeared?
Yeah, I mean, that's something that we really grapple with. We come back from our field seasons increasingly broken from the experience of the work that we're doing. And, you know, and the same would be true of people who are working on issues of overfishing, pollution, all sorts of these environmental stresses. You go out to study, you think, now I've got a really strong experiment, I know exactly what I'm going to go and do. And then you get underwater for the first day, and at that point you're hit just by what a devastating landscape or seascape you're looking at. And so I guess you've got options. You know, you can either think, well, I can't do this. I'm afraid I'm going to have to change the science that I do. I'm going to have to work on a different question, on a different system. Or you might try and internalise all of that pain that you feel. And lots of people do that. They feel as scientists that we should be objective, we should be very robust, we should be effectively not at the mercy of our emotions when we're doing our science. And to some extent, that's true. We need to be objective with the way that we're asking questions, the way that we're designing our experiments. But increasingly, I think we're realizing that we can use that emotional response to form the questions in the first place. So we might think that actually working on the bleached and dying coral reefs is enormously important. Now, that's all negative, obviously. That's us thinking about how do we deal with the fact that we're seeing such devastation. The other thing that we're increasingly now thinking about is how do we take the knowledge, this gained knowledge that we're accumulating, and turn it on its head, turn it into solutions? Because, you know, I think in lots of us, there is this real urge to want to do something about it rather than just chart the demise.
So despite his grief at the loss of these stunning habitats, and perhaps as a way of dealing with this loss, Steve Simpson and his team have moved into restoration.
We've gone from really developing understanding of the natural world, hugely exciting. And in this case, it was discovering that fish are able to use their acoustic world as a way of finding their way around, of choosing where they want to live. To then realising with the Great Barrier Reef bleaching events and the cyclones that the reef had gone quiet. You know, it was three quarters as quiet as it was, say, 10 years ago. And so no longer could the fish, the next generation of fish, hear their way home. That was tragic, but we thought then, well, hang on a minute, because we've got these historic recordings, what happens if we play them back around new habitat to see whether we can bring in the next generation of fish and start to re-establish fish communities?
And did it work?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's the study that has just been published that Tim Gordon has been the lead scientist on at Lizard Island over the last 3 years. What we found was that we were able over 6 weeks to start to rebuild fish communities in degraded habitat environments.
Jamie Craggs is another coral biologist who's witnessed the devastation of corals. He now works at the Hornimer Museum in South London on a project that aims to grow endangered corals in the hope of restoring damaged reefs in the future. We meet in the museum's aquarium, which features a range of different marine ecosystems side by side in tanks, from European coastal zones to a tropical reef full of colourful fish.
You have to be a very privileged person to go and see many of these ecosystems around the world, and that's very much the function of our aquarium, is to open, you know, those ecosystems to people that can't get there, so they can see an example of it within the museum here.
Now, I know that here there is a really important global project to somehow try and give us a bit of hope about these coral reef ecosystems that are so fragile. Tell me a little bit about what you're trying to do here.
So in order for a habitat to continue, we need to understand how an animal reproduces to reseed the next generation into that ecosystem. The majority of corals, they spawn, they release their eggs and sperm into the water over a few short nights of the year. Traditionally, to understand coral reproduction, you might go out into the field on the night that they spawn, collect the eggs and sperm, and then have the material to do your experiment, your studies. Or more commonly that's happening is you would bring in that brood stock into a lab, allow it to spawn, and then put it back afterwards. The problem is you literally have a few nights a year to get that material, and you have to be close to a reef location to be able to study it.
Which we're not here in South London.
Exactly. So we wanted to study reproduction, and to do that we needed to understand what triggers these spawning events to happen in the wild, and then how do we emulate all of those, simulate those same environmental parameters that trigger them, but do that in an aquarium in London. Once we've done that, we've been working on this 7 years now, we've had lots and lots of coral spawning. Now the next phase is breaking all the natural cycles so that you can trigger them to spawn out of season by manipulating the environment, which means that you're not then bound by the natural rhythm. You could spawn them more frequently, which gives you more access to material. You can understand some of those impacts of climate change quicker, and then how we can mitigate some of those impacts.
Right, well, should we have a look at some of this little artificial sexual setup?
Absolutely.
Behind the scenes? Exciting. So, Jamie, what are all these huge blackout blinds for?
So, behind these are each of our research systems. So, what we've done is we've reversed the light cycle to make the coral spawn in our daytime. So, the idea behind these blackout blinds is we don't want our sun to influence the day-night cycle of the corals. So we have to block out all the external light factors and control the daylight and moonlight.
Because you want to be there for that all-important coral spawning event, which only happens a day or two a year, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we know when each of the species should spawn in the wild, and simply looking at our clocks and the data that we've put in, we can then work out which days we should be focusing on to get them to spawn and then collect those eggs and sperm and do the in vitro fertilisation.
We were talking about ecological grief, but that must be a very joyous occasion, seeing literally the birth of new life.
Absolutely. I mean, in these tanks behind, we have something like 200,000 baby corals that have just settled. We're running our next experiment. And a lot of our experiments is trying to look at applied uses of our techniques so that we can rebuild reefs. That's fundamentally the driving factor behind our research.
So you're preparing for a world in which reefs can still survive?
Yeah, I mean, I think the group of people, scientists, working on rebuilding reefs, it's called reef restoration. I don't think any of those scientists would say that this is a solution against climate change. You know, fundamentally, we need to stop climate change to give reefs a future. Reef restoration is about buying time. That's very much what it's about. If we can give enough time to those species so that these big issues of climate change can be tackled, then hopefully that provides the glimmer of hope that is needed for these species to continue in the future.
And when I see these adorable baby corals growing in your tank, it makes me feel happy. I see the colours there, and I know it's a very fragile system and it's all a very artificial system, but still they are surviving somewhere.
One of the things that we've been talking about from a public aquarium perspective, could there be a coordinated effort to mobilise our resources to act as living gene banks for reefs in the future? And I think, you know, there's certainly an appetite for that, and we're moving towards that as well.
Trying to do something about environmental problems we face can help researchers channel their grief. But as scientists start acknowledging their feelings about environmental devastation, Andy Radford is calling for more support.
One thing that we're arguing very strongly for at the moment is that it needs to be beyond what individuals like I can do as a research group leader, you know, and talking to individual students. There actually needs to be more in place in academia, in environmental science, at sort of institutional levels. So in other walks of life,
Do you mean mental health counsellors in universities?
Well, that's one possibility. I think, you know, much can be learned by looking at things like the medical profession or the armed forces, where, you know, everybody recognises that there's huge amounts of grief can be generated for workers in those types of fields. And those fields, those job places, have in place various mechanisms, various procedures, various opportunities to help those individuals overcome grief. And, you know, one thing that we're arguing for is that perhaps we need to take a leaf out of those books. We need to learn from that. And academia, environmental science needs to put in place some more of those opportunities, processes to help with the grief, of which, yes, counselling is one.
What other sorts of ideas might be there?
Well, I think it's some, at least, of this is just also making it clear that it is perfectly acceptable to acknowledge, to talk about these feelings. It's very easy sometimes for people to say, well, you just need to get over it. You know, there's nothing that can be done. You know, just get over it, move on. And of course, that's not very sympathetic at all. And it's not very helpful. So even just making it more viable for people to talk in open forums, to discuss with others who are experiencing this, is a valuable opportunity, alongside perhaps more structured things like well-being and mental health provision.
But it's still early days for the scientific community in providing counselling for those affected. Courtney Howard has started running workshops for people with ecological grief and anxiety, and I met her just after she'd been at the International Climate Meeting in Madrid, where her workshops were very popular with the delegates, some of whom were suffering from burnout.
What we know from the evidence is that coming together is one really helpful thing. So it's, you know, if you're isolated in your grief, if you're a climate scientist, or even you're someone who's doing a lot of reading in the blue light of your computer screen at 1 a.m, then you're anxious and worried and isolated and lonely. So we know that by coming together to talk about it, and I think that this kind of a program is something that can really be helpful. This will reach somebody in their kitchen somewhere who to this point has been the only person they knew who was this worried. And it's important for people to know that it is absolutely normal to be feeling upset at this moment in time. You are right. We are living at a crux point in human civilization, and it is absolutely normal to be upset and to be for that to be changing your view of the world. But by coming together, immediately we can talk to people who are having a similar reaction and know that we're not alone and know that that's normal. So that is one way of helping. And then taking productive action is also really helpful. So there are studies that show that if you're part of a group and you're taking action on, you know, a project and there's an outcome that's perceived as successful, that feels good. It gives you an empowering feeling. And so what we say is that action feels better than anxiety. And so that's a message I often give to audiences who haven't plugged in yet, to be like, hey, like, I do this because it feels good. And you'll feel better as you figure out exactly where your skill sets can best integrate into the effort of this low carbon transition.
When Ashley Consolo found herself feeling ecological grief, she too found benefits from talking to others.
Back in 2011, when I was experiencing my own very severe ecological grief and really feeling like I was unsure of how to deal with my own emotions and how to move forward, you know, I had the opportunity to sit down with some elders in Nunatsiavut and talk about this. And I hadn't really been sharing it with anyone. And I didn't want my pain to silence anyone else's pain or take away from pain. So I was kind of just absorbing the pain of others and suppressing my own. And I finally started talking. And it was a really amazing moment because I was really worried about, you know, sharing those things. And I felt as soon as I started talking about it, there was this openness and this sense of embracing that comes when we talk about things like grief. And it's a shared emotion. It's something that, you know, no one will come into this world without losing someone or something. So we all understand grief and loss. And that's really what I was learning from the elders was this isn't something that we should shy away from, that often so many cultures in our world in recent times have done a really poor job of preparing ourselves to be healthy and emotionally healthy during times of loss. We often talk in the work that I do about finding the awe. So the awe in the everyday with the environment. And so if you've had that and it's lost, yes, mourn the loss. That's very important. But also remember that in that mourning, it's actually a celebration and an honoring of what relationships and connections we've had. And then through the leadership of those elders, they started bringing other people in the communities together to talk about what we were finding in research and to have people share their experiences and their grief. And then it was also through the leadership of elders and other community leaders that suggested making the documentary film as a way not only to share what Inuit were experiencing with the world, but also to start these open conversations around grief and loss and what we're doing to the world. And to start, as the elders are saying, to let other people know that it's okay to talk about. Because often we feel that these things aren't okay or aren't normal or we're ashamed. And so really bringing that out. And I think that that's something that I feel incredibly inspired about.
Humanity is changing the world rapidly and with devastating consequences for many of the landscapes and ecosystems that we love and depend on. It's only natural that we feel grief and anxious about the world we're leaving our children. The researchers we've heard from, though, are drawing strength from community, talking about these emotions. And they're finding solace in taking action for a positive future. Even as we mourn what we've lost, we can protect what remains and celebrate that.
What if you could get a piece of advice from one of your heroes?
It's really nice to be able to talk to the man who cut the cord off the telephone.
What would it be?
You don't have to know what you want to do, but just don't let anyone tell you that you can't do something.
And how would it make you feel?
I don't think I've had anybody say that to me, like, just to keep pushing. And it's really great to hear that.
In our new podcast, World Wise Web, teenagers like me get to spend time with technological innovators who have already changed the world.
I'm just somebody who is in the right place at the right time and asking the right questions, that's all.
That's World Wise Web from the BBC World Service.
You got to make it happen for yourself. Yeah, you can't just wait for it to happen to you. Grab it. Go for it.
Search for World Wise Web wherever you get your podcasts.
I will never forget what he said.